This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 22nd of October 2013 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Section D, the weekly design hour here on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we find out there's a lot more to Canadian style than just keeping warm at Toronto Fashion Week.
What makes a successful designer in Toronto is someone who has their roots here but is also kind of looking at other cities to show in or to sell in.
We meet with hotel design guru Ian Schrager about the launch of London's hottest new place to rest your head for the night.
What we've done here is try to combine the best of an English country manner with the best of urban, edgy living and maybe a little punk thrown in there for good measure.
And we head to Lisbon, first to find out about the state of Portuguese architecture today, and then to have a nose around the city's homes during its recent open house weekend.
I think it's always a victory because you're always dealing with someone that has no reason to open their house and they do it freely. Instead of showing them what you're exhibiting, you're showing the building.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. Torontonians have been dressed in their finest this week as they head out to attend Toronto Fashion Week. Since IMG took over in 2012, industry insiders are saying that the event has upped its game. Monocle's Jason Lee spoke to women's wear designer Caitlin Power and Matt Robinson, founder of men's label Claxon Howell, to see how they're getting ready for the catwalk and what they expect from this edition of Toronto Fashion Week.
The unveiling.
So we put everything together in looks from our model fitting. What are some strong pieces? The Hawaiian prints that we did this season, these were based on 1940s sort of bark cloth textiles, so that they would have been a much larger version of what we have, a tropical kind of Black Panther and palm trees and flowers kind of thing. You're sort of typical, not typical, but a 40s inspired Hawaiian print. So these are quite good. And that was a custom print. This is something that we got printed here in Toronto. So nobody else is going to have this print, which is quite cool.
That's menswear designer Matt Robinson from Claxon Howell giving me a sneak peek into his collection showing at the World Mastercard Toronto Fashion Week. He's known for his military-inspired clothes that draw from the mid-20th century. I ask him how he balances old and new in this year's collection.
When you look at a lot of our stuff, I don't think it looks period or costumey, so that's the sort of slippery slope you have to navigate, making it look contemporary but pulling influences and details and designs from the past.
How is this year's collection different from previous year's collections?
This season we did a lot of short sleeves, a lot of lighter fabrics. In the past I had sort of been anti-short sleeve. You know, we may show one or two shirtings in short sleeve. Like last season, last spring, summer, SS13, we did quite a few short sleeves, and we did some sort of gauzier, lighter sort of lawns and dolby cloths and, you know, lighter fabrics, and that was a success. So we've sort of continued off of that and played off of that.
In terms of, like, creative input, is it just you, or do you have someone you're working with? Or it's all really just you?
Well, I work closely with my wife. She's, you know, a good sounding board, but, you know, we don't always agree on everything. So there are times where I'll just go ahead and do something, even though she may not may not think it's the best course. You know, if it does well in the shop, then great. I don't have to hear about it, and I can flaunt it a little bit. And if it does poorly, then I hear about it, and, you know, have to live with that.
Another anticipated designer putting her finishing touches on her women's wear collection is Caitlin Power, whose collection this year celebrates colors while retaining a tailored classic look.
So this is one of the pieces that's going to be part of the showpiece three-piece collection. So there's going to be three looks at the very end of the show that are going to be all done in leather and this kind of like chevron shape, which kind of brings the tribal techno inspiration together. The Caitlin Power brand is catered to the modern day career woman. And it's very strong lines, classic tailoring, but with like a modern edge to it.
How do you keep a brand classic and still be relevant, changing trends and like latest trends?
I find I don't follow too many trends of silhouette trends. I'll look at colors and then kind of go with that. But I keep the lines very tailored and very classic and then just change up the little details and make those kind of current.
What makes this collection so different from your previous collections?
The latest collection is Spring-Summer 2014, and it's inspired by my recent trip to St. Martin. I was there for a Women with Purpose Global Summit, and I was really inspired by the culture there, the music, the colors, and you can really see that in the collection. This collection, I've used probably the most amount of white I've ever used, and it's has some brighter colors.
Can you tell us some interesting anecdotes that happen at a runway show for you?
Actually, there was one time we had one of the models come to us right before the show, like 5 minutes before she had to go on, and she's like, there's a hole in the back of her pants, just in the butt, and I'm like, so I just like grabbed the pants and like ran over to my sewing kit and quickly just stitched it up, but it was just like, okay, you got to just deal with it. You got to, roll with it.
What do you think makes a successful designer in Toronto? Because it's so competitive. And to be honest, Toronto isn't seen as a fashion hub.
What makes a successful designer in Toronto is someone who has their roots here, but is also kind of looking at other cities to show in or to sell in. Just so then that gives you like more variety and kind of to boost up your brand in other countries and cities.
Since IMG took over the reins of Toronto Fashion Week in 2012, both Caitlin and Matt agree that it has gained more international recognition and has given Toronto's designers a boost in confidence.
It's definitely changed it since they took over last season. It definitely seems more organized and more consistent. There's sort of like an expected level of the services that they deliver and the way it's presented. And I think that continuity is kind of important too. And I mean, it's a brand in itself and for us too, for that sort of confidence. So yeah, it's great. And the fact that they do shows internationally definitely adds a cachet and a legitimacy that maybe wasn't there before. So hopefully it will be taken more seriously and garner some more attention and press and things like that. Yeah.
I think on the media end, I'm really finding it this season, the media has really kind of got involved a whole lot more. So maybe they're just noticing that IMG has taken over and they just want to get more involved.
Even though not as internationally acclaimed as Milan or New York, Toronto Fashion Week remains the best platform for homegrown talent to showcase their work. And it seems that more around the world are taking notice. So while models strut down the runways this week, I'm betting that designers are keeping their fingers crossed just a little bit tighter. For Monocle in Toronto, I'm Jason Lee.
This is Section D with me, Tom Morris. Chances are you've heard of the decadent and glamorous world of Studio 54, one of the world's most successful nightclubs ever, which shut down amidst a scandal just a few years after opening. Following the closure, its co-founder Ian Schrager then decided to go into hospitality and residential industries instead. Over the course of the next 30 years, he opened a series of innovative hotels, ranging from the Delano in Miami to London's infamous St. Martin's and Sanderson hotels. Often seen as the pioneer of the boutique hotel, Schrager returned to London this September to inaugurate his latest project, the London Editions Hotel in Central Fitzrovia. Monocle's Alexa Firmanich caught up with Schrager in the hotel's punch room to chat about the building's design and how he sees the evolution in the hotel industry.
The concept of the boutique as we envisioned it has not become dated. It has evolved and has grown up with its customer base. But I think the word's been misused and misunderstood by everyone. I think it's changed the entire industry. And you can see it. Every brand, every major hotel company is doing things that are focused on a better experience and not just efficient execution.
So, I mean, these days, what do you think it means to be a boutique hotel? Would you classify your latest projects under that banner or the addition? Is this something completely different and maybe not boutique anymore?
I hate the word boutique hotel. My partner invented it. When we did our first hotel back in the 80s, we were in New York City, which is one of the fashion capitals of the world and very much involved with fashion and influenced by fashion. Our friends were a lot of the fashion designers. So when we were trying to describe to people what we were trying to do, we said we were doing a boutique rather than a department store. All the other hotels were department stores. They tried to be all things to all people. We had a very specific, focused attitude. We had something very specific to say. We were an alternative to what was available out there. That, to me, was what a boutique. It had nothing to do with size. It had nothing to do with a lot of the other criteria that are now being used by people. The word has actually been adopted by the English language. We don't own it anymore. But to me, a lifestyle hotel, which is what I like to say rather than boutique, is something that has something specific to say. It's a subversive to the status quo. It's an alternative to what's currently available out there. And it has a very elevated experience. That can be a 10,000-room boutique hotel, or it could be a 3-room boutique hotel, and or a lifestyle hotel. And yes, I consider the addition a lifestyle hotel because it has something specific to say.
So maybe you could actually describe a little bit of what we see around us in this room and in the hotel.
Well, the best way to see the way I have evolved and how the idea, the way I interpret it, has evolved is to take a look at what I did at the Saunderson 15 years ago, which is down the block, and come in here and see this hotel. I think this hotel, everything has been kind of pared down and reduced to its essence. It's simple. There's no contrivance. People feel good in it. And it's very hard to do something that gets so edited and purified and reduced down to its essence. It's like a rebellion against what I call design on steroids, which is what everyone is like so overzealous with the design, and people don't really understand what it is to do a cool place, so they think the color of the couch matters when it really doesn't at all. It's about how it makes people feel rather than the way it looks. So I think what we've done here is try to combine the best of an English country manor, maybe a home that an aristocrat would live in, with the best of urban, edgy living, and maybe a little punk thrown in there for good measure. And so to try and come up with a space that is impossible to date or categorize, that just feels good, and it feels simple, and it's not coming in here and saying, look at the design. It's coming in and saying, boy, it feels great to be in here. It's glamorous, but I feel comfortable. I can be in here in a gown, or I can be in here a pair of jeans. It kind of works.
But how do you reconcile that, you know, English aristocratic, old school glamour with the new modern, edgy, maybe a little bit of technology? I saw when we walked in, you have these Mac computers out. How do you reconcile those two concepts?
They're not reconcilable. I mean, it's like a boulevard. You know, you kind of throw it in there, and when you put unlikely things together, that's when an alchemy can happen. A spark can happen. It can go to someplace unanticipated. Couldn't put down in a book where this project was going to end up when we started. It's a work in progress. But I think that balancing act, I think that methodology of combining diverse things that aren't ordinarily put together, by doing that and accomplishing that, almost like a kind of organized chaos, it comes together and feels quite calm and quite simple.
And this is part of a larger project that you're doing with Marriott, the Edition Hotels in general. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about that project.
Well, really trying to combine the best of what I do, which is kind of very personalized, individualized, one-off, custom-made projects, with a really great company like Marriott, who's kind of, you know, focused on efficiencies of execution. You know, completely different approaches. But by combining the best of both, you know, we both get an opportunity to do something we might not otherwise do alone. You know, I've been in the business a long time, and I've done 15 or 16 hotels. You know, Marriott been in the business longer than I have, but they have 3,800 hotels. So the idea of doing something on a grand scale and doing it quickly was kind of attractive to me, because I never did anything like that before. And it was kind of fun to try and do it.
So what do you think sets a great hotel apart from an average one these days? You have so many hotels always opening. People, especially our society, were used to changes and adapting to different situations. So what do you think makes things stand out?
I often give this example. It may seem silly, but, you know, in the United States, there was a Supreme Court case that was trying to decide what pornography was. And the judge says, well, I can't define it, but we all know it when we see it. And I think the same thing with the Great Hotel. You know, you go in there and you instantly know when you're in a special place.
I mean, that's what's admirable. It's been almost 40 years that you keep reinventing and keep bringing out new concepts. You really have to be in tune.
You know, I know a funny thing is like we have a nightclub downstairs. And it's a real hot little nightclub that I think is really, really great. You know how that happened? Like I was, I don't really have very much to do with Studio 54 anymore. So a friend of mine has Sirius Radio, and he has a Studio 54 radio station. So he asked me to do a Studio 54 party for him, which I did because he's a friend and I like him. And I took my daughters there. And so we had all these lighting effects going on. And I asked my daughters, and they were like jaw-dropped when they saw it all. And I asked them if they would like something like that, and they said yes. So I decided to do a kind of modern version of that, you know, without all the indulgence, and it's a different time and smaller, but the same, you know, basic idea, and I think it's gonna be great.
That was Ian Schrager talking to Alexa Firmanich about his new London venture, the London Editions Hotel. After the break, we'll be in New York.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D with me, Tom Morris. Answer us this. How does living and working in New York shape contemporary studio practice on the level of scale, geography, and day-to-day organisation? What does graphic design in New York look like? Any ideas? These were the problems posed by a recent exhibition at Cooper Union in New York entitled Image of the Studio. The curators of the show asked 75 graphic design studios for their responses, and they each responded with a series of original work that is being displayed in the exhibition. Co-curated and organised by the Herb Lublin Study Centre at the Cooper Union and the Creative Studio Athletics, Image of the Studio attempts to document what's going on in graphic design in New York today, a dynamic discipline in an ever-evolving city. Monocle's Go Kazai went to find out more.
We sort of sat down together, and one of the main things about the exhibition is to sort of paint the larger picture of what graphic design means in New York City, especially within 2013. And in particular, the Lube Allen Center, you know, one of their main focuses is sort of archiving and the sort of history of graphic design. And I think this exhibition in particular is our attempt to sort of capture this moment in graphic design.
I think for me, one of the things that we wanted to do is kind of keep in line with some of the exhibitions we've been doing for a while and the kind of the legacy and the history of the Lube Allen Center. The exhibitions have been kind of part of the Lube Allen Center's history since 1985, and so it's a very rich kind of area, but most of the exhibitions tend to kind of position graphic design in some sort of perspective. It's never really like the best stuff show. There's always kind of an educational component to every exhibition because it's part of the Cooper Union, and there's kind of an emphasis on the pedagogy that's here. So all the shows have to be a little bit more kind of geared, at least to some degree, towards the students. And I think for a lot of students, it's kind of the world of studio and graphic design. When they're in school is one thing. When they're out, it's a completely different thing. And this is like sort of a really nice glimpse into what's sort of waiting for them out there.
And so for this exhibit, there were like two questions that were being asked. It's how does living and working in New York shape contemporary studio practice? And what does graphic design in New York look like? And so what is your opinion about how New York shapes graphic design and what it looks like?
I mean, I think the exhibition, having worked with so many different design firms to put it together, you kind of understand that the urban space has this sort of interesting accessibility to everyone, that sort of almost every studio can't imagine, you know, their studio being anywhere else. So that's very interesting. And then I also think, for me, all the studios have a kind of restlessness that feeds off the sort of New York City as well. And I think it's been a very interesting observation to see how the city, in New York in particular, has a great history and legacy and energy that each studio feeds off in a really unique way.
I think one of the more interesting things about the kind of doing this exhibition is you start to realize how much how important graphic design is to New York City and how vital it is within the city, and you realize how deep the roots are. You know, one of the things that we were looking at is being able to see like where some of the people have moved around, and New York is such an important place for design studios to be based, and you see how deep the roots are and how much people really want to be here in New York City, and like sort of moving from one place to another, there's a very deep sense of like people being really connected, you know, like the interconnections between the studios. I think it's not an exaggeration, but pretty much every studio that we have an exhibition, and probably most of the studios, someone at some point knew someone, worked somewhere. The lines are so deep and so crossed. You know, we're trying to make some infographics, and just it was almost impenetrable the amount of connections that there are. So I think it just speaks to the complexity and kind of the vitality of New York City, or at least like graphic design New York City.
And just to follow up, earlier you mentioned that, you know, this is the exhibit is taking place in Cooper Union, where they're accessible by students. What would you like the students to take away from this exhibit?
One of the things I think that would be great for students to take away is to see how many options there are for them. I think I myself, as a practicing graphic designer, as a graduate of Cooper Union, when I was in school, this notion of being able to start your own studio out of school was sort of blasphemy. Like, this just didn't happen. The fact that you can do it, and so many studios in the show are based off people going from school or going from another studio very early on, being able to do the work that they do and being very successful and kind of have the freedom that they do, is a completely new paradigm. And I think for students to realize how many options there are for them, and it's not, you know, it's one thing that wasn't around when I was in school. I think that's something that's really important for them to see, the range of things that they can do, the possibilities that they have.
As a designer, I went through sort of graduate school and undergraduate, and I think as a professional designer, if I were a student coming to this show, I think the big takeaway is that the distance between being a student and being a practicing professional, is that gap is becoming so much more narrow. And that what you're doing at 19 or 20, it's just a stepping stone for what you're doing when you're 20, 25, 30. And that you don't come out of the academic setting at a trot, it's at a sprint. And I think this show kind of reflects that energy and that kind of immediacy of the discipline. And, you know, for me, I'm really excited to teach students and to share work with students. And I think this is a great opportunity for all of us to kind of turn our lens outward as studios and share that with students. So,
and how were you able to corral 75 studios to exhibit here?
We sent an email out and kind of did research to a lot of studios, like between, I don't know, 80 and 100. And I think we have 78 in the show. And, you know, wrangling everyone was really difficult and challenging. I think as the show progressed over 5 months, and Allison Cannell, our colleague, was really adamant and reminding people. And, you know, I think what you need to do for any big show like this is to paint the picture of what it's going to be early on so that people get excited about it. And I think for us we're a small design firm as well. And it's almost like we put together this project thinking it was a good idea, and it became very, very ambitious. And I think the quality of the work and the caliber of work is sort of a testament to the studios that chose to be in the exhibition really put forth their all. So
I think one of the things that was challenging is definitely kind of figuring out who, you know, could be in the exhibition. We definitely tried to cover as much territory as we could and include everyone. One of the main things that we really wanted to focus is to kind of have a very democratic platform to have access to large studios, small studios, medium size, so pretty much like everything. And there's quite a few like one person studios in the exhibition, and that's like I think really unique and celebrates the vitality and kind of the variety of studios there are. We try to make sure that everyone sort of was felt included. Doesn't mean like as long as you have a physical space and you're practicing graphic design, that's really kind of the benchmark that we need. And there's definitely like no, you know, there's professional organizations, but there's no centralized place where you can see like these are all of the studios that practice graphic design. So in some ways I think like this exhibition and the web component of it will be sort of this very lasting moment of being able to kind of capture and have this one centralized place, like this is what's going on in New York City and these are the studios that are practicing design. And in some ways, that website probably will become something more and more vital as a central place where people can see. And we will have kind of a dynamic quality where things could be updated. And as the studios change, the website can change too. So I think it will be kind of a very important asset to the community, you know, at large for kind of even after the fact of the exhibition being done and over.
That was Go Kazai reporting in New York there. Earlier in the show, we took a look at fashion in Toronto, and now we're taking a peek into architecture in the city. Not many people know this, but some consider the city to be the birthplace of flexible and adaptable building design. The city has a short but festooned history of constructing edifices in a way that they are easily transformed to support different needs. In 1988, the city's Sky Dome revolutionised the way architects approached designing buildings with its retractable roof, moving away from static, rigid structures. 15 years later, the city played host to the International Conference on Adaptation and Movement in Architecture just this month. Monocle's Jason Lee attended the conference and spoke with two key people leading this conversation.
Canada is the country with first movable structure, and that's a Sky Dome. The Sky Dome is the first example of movable structures. And I hope, at least in Canada, we should see more example of transformable structures in near futures.
That is Professor Mazir Asifi, the chair of the International Conference on Adaptation and Movement in Architecture, held this year at Ryerson University in Toronto. A group of 40 or so architects and academics from Denmark to New Zealand have gathered to answer his call to think and discuss ways in which buildings can be designed to be flexible and mobile enough to meet changing demands. I ask him why this conversation is so pertinent today.
Actually, the idea of transformation and movement in architecture is not a new concept. It was used before by nomadic people when they have to move from places to places. But the thing is, we have more people researching on the idea of transformation, and they're going to apply this concept into architecture. Everything is changing in the world. So when everything is changing, we can just stick with static architecture. We can continue designing buildings that users has not any connection, any contribution to design. Because, you know, when someone gets a shelter designed by an architect, he or she wants to live in that building for a long time. And during that period, his or her requirement is changing.
So talking about transformability, you kind of need to predict future conditions or changing conditions. So what is the strategy here in thinking of like changing conditions? You know, is the way to go like modular and prefab so everything can be dismantled easily and put back together? Or
actually, we have different kind. We can think about transformation in two different categories. Transformable system, in the first category, we have transformable structures that all components of the structures can open and close. So we don't need to add any additional elements to make it to make the structure stable. So we call this type of structures fully transformable system. But the things that we have another type of buildings, we call them dismountable system. In those buildings, we can use some structural elements that can be detached from the structures after use. And when we are going to erect a structure on site, we just need to assemble the whole system.
Do you see a difference in terms of how architects are thinking in different parts of the world?
I have been connected with so many people in different parts of the world that are working on the idea of transformability. So it's a kind of universal idea now. For example, for Japanese, we have too many earthquakes in Japan. And we have a special kind of structure called tensegrity structures, which is a combination of cable and strut, and it's a kind of flexible system.
The keynote speaker for the conference is Professor Robert Cronenberg from Liverpool, who spent the last 25 years addressing the question, if human beings are adaptable, why can't buildings be just as flexible? His latest book, Architecture in Motion, has some of the current answers. He tells me that when he first started his research, adaptable architecture barely registered on anyone's radar.
At that time, mobile architecture was really not perceived as architecture as such. It was just seen as kind of the lowest common form of building, if it was thought of as buildings at all. And it wasn't really seen as a distinct genre at all. And so that was my kind of intuition, that this there really was an architecture here. And it stemmed from, first of all, looking at traditional architectures, in which there was a lot of traditional architecture which was mobile and flexible and adaptable. And making that connection between the traditional forms and what was happening in contemporary architecture was an important leap, which hadn't really been made.
Could you tell us what the hallmarks of flexible architecture are?
Yeah, well, it's an architecture that responds to change. It's an architecture that is has a certain indeterminacy in its form. It's where people have an engagement with it which is not just passive, an active engagement. And it's an architecture which has a potential that is perhaps unperceived at the time that it is initially designed.
Where does aesthetics fit into the entire conceptualization of flexible architecture?
Aesthetics are actually a very important part of all architecture, because aesthetics are a key way in which people relate to architecture. And I think there is one key aesthetic, if you like, which this flexible, adaptable architecture has, and that is that it's dynamic. It appears generally as if it is intended to have this mobile or flexible identity. And I think that's something that people connect with.
And what are the main obstacles when it comes to building a flexible building? Is it materials or is it design?
Well, it's impossible to predict fully what will happen in the future. There used to be an idea in the past that a good way to build was to design something on the theme of long life, loose fit, and that was basically a loose building that could just accommodate anything that went on between it. Now, I don't agree with that, because a loose fit means that it doesn't actually work particularly well for any of the things that might happen in the future or now. So what has to happen is that people design buildings that are absolutely the best they can possibly be for what we see at the moment and in the foreseeable future, but the things that they design into the building are sufficiently agile so that once we do know exactly what we need, we can make another building, or change that building rather, so that it's right for that use then.
Which architects or projects do you think are leading the way and really excite you in terms of like the next cutting edge idea?
There's a practice from Japan called Studio Bow Wow, which are actually artists stroke architects who deal purely in mobile temporary stuff. And in the USA, architects such as FTL out of New York and Low-Tech.
Your book is just published. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, Architecture in Motion is actually a book which is based on research which I have been doing for many, many years. And so it sets out the history, the context of mobile architecture, but it also talks about why it is even more important now to consider this as an option for buildings which are being designed today, for the near future and into the future.
That was Monocle's Jason Lee reporting from Toronto. Now we're leaving Canada and heading over to Portugal, to the capital city of Lisbon, coming up next.
You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24, our weekly program on the best in design, architecture, graphics, and fashion. Section D is brought to you by Lexus. Lexus, creating a new chapter in amazing design, technology, and driving.
Welcome back to Section D on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Morris. Now to what is becoming a favourite design stop for the Section D team, Portugal's beautiful capital of Lisbon. Long seen as the home of masterful Baroque, neoclassical, and modernist architecture, Portugal had for a long time suffered from being marginalised as a minor presence on the European scene. That very much changed during the course of the 1990s, when Portuguese architects such as Álvaro Siza and Eduardo Souto de Moura raised the game for this small nation's standing on the global stage. Another name very much associated with the very best of contemporary architecture is Aires Mateus. Its two offices in Lisbon have managed to produce some discreetly iconic buildings and structures that have been praised for their formal and intellectual rigour. Monocle's David Pleasant met one of the firm's senior architects, George Silva, to find out what makes his teams and his country's buildings so successful, despite the gloomy economic climate.
The studio has always been focused in considering architecture as an investigation path. I've been working with them for more than 15 years now, and so I have had the chance to see a lot of projects being developed that later became kind of milestones in all the way that the studio has been doing. And what I can say about this process, either for small projects or even for bigger projects, is that the work in the studio is always seen, and each project has the chance to reach a stage where we had never been before. And by this, I mean that there is not really a strategy of speech or of language in the design, but each house or each public building is developed considering their own constraints and their own conditions, let's say, in order to achieve a new and surprising result even for us. And this means that all the projects, they are very different to one another for us, although obviously if you are on the outside you might identify some common DNA from one project to the other, but they are always a part of a wider process of investigation.
Over many years, Portugal has acquired a fantastic reputation for contemporary architecture and seems to have been a breeding ground for some truly kind of inspiring experiments in terms of form and kind of intellectual approach to architecture. Is that not a big influence, despite the kind of global nature of what you're trying to do? Is there some influence? Can you perhaps talk about the environment, you know, Lisbon, where we are, what's that relationship between the architecture and where it's come from?
Well, I think that that there's a characteristic in Portugal which is maybe peculiar, which is although geographically the country is very small, there's a huge difference, a huge cultural difference between the north and the south of Portugal. And this means that the people in the south, in the Algarve or Alentejo, which are regions of which are below Lisbon, let's say, they have a relationship with their environment, with the light, with the sun, which is extremely different from the relationship that the people in the north establish with the environment. It's also, and this means that in the south there is a lot more sun. All the context, it's very dry. And in the north, close to Porto and Braga and other cities that are in the north, you have a very different climate. And obviously that affects also the culture of people, the way people use the public space, the way people use even the private spaces, because you have to recur to much more to indoor spaces in the north to gather your family or to gather your friends, whereas in the south you can use the public square, you can use the benches that you find on the street, and you meet your friends and you meet your family on the outside. This array of different contexts, I think that it's one of the responsibilities for the architects in Portugal to be so used to thinking about each design, the very careful identification of what are the conditions. And what I mean by this is that obviously there's also another thing which is really important, which is the craftsmanship that we still have very present up to our days, available for construction. So it's still possible to find extremely good carpenters and blacksmiths and masons and all of that. Also with this asset, you can design very customized solutions for each area where you are working, and at the same time that also forces you to pay a lot more attention to all those conditions. And I think that that is also one characteristic that has passed to the most well-known architects in Portugal, because when you look at Álvaro Siza's work, and you can look at it in the buildings in the north or in the south of Portugal, but also everywhere else in Europe, or even in Korea or in Brazil. And he has always been very concentrated in working with the difference. So instead of just finding a way to think about architecture, I think that the architects in Portugal have always tried to find the different conditions in their, in the contexts where they're working. And that has probably given the architects, the Portuguese architects, an ability to work anywhere in the world with the same care and with the same attention for the places or for the conditions that, that they get.
Do you feel optimistic about what you're doing, your work, and your colleagues, if not the rest of the architectural community here in Portugal? Do you feel that you have something that, that perhaps is unique and may be a positive in these very difficult times?
Well, I'm not really sure if it's going, if it is positive or not. One thing that everybody realizes is that a lot of our friends and a lot of the students that just come out of university, they right now they tend to just think to go abroad and to go to other countries and find more opportunities elsewhere. And that's kind of a pity right now, because we feel that there's a lot of talent that it's really flying away.
They may come back, no?
They might, yes, and they might come back with different knowledges and improve the conditions for everybody. But at the same time, I cannot be very pessimistic or optimistic for the future. Right now, what we have been living in the last 5 years, it's an uncertainty that does not allow us to now make plans in 3 or 4 or 5 years or even reason too much about what's going to happen, because what we have realized is that even the economical situation in Portugal is very much affected by guidelines that are established elsewhere in other countries. Right now it's trying to find the rules of this new paradigm. So for us it's something that we have to work with, but it's not something that limits us. It's the new rules, and we are adapting to it naturally.
That was George Silva, senior architect Aires Mateus, talking to Monocle's David Pleasant at their offices in Lisbon. We're staying in Lisbon now. Earlier this month, the city opened the doors to over 60 sites of architectural interest as part of its second open house weekend, an event that allows city dwellers to discover their buildings and neighbourhoods in a totally new way. As well as famous national institutions and protected monuments, Open House Lisboa unlocks some surprising spaces that attract an unforeseen number of curious visitors. Simon Tarek goes for a wander.
Last year, an eerie harpsichord recital launched the first Lisbon Open House weekend at the Grand Sinal do Cordes Palace. Originally belonging to 18th century Portuguese nobility, the palace has in its time housed royal Italian diplomats, a public primary school, and now the Lisbon Architecture Triennial headquarters. Now in its second year, the goal of Open House Lisbon has remained the same: to provide a unique citizen-led survey of urban experience by opening buildings across the city. Triennial Executive Director Manuel Henrique tells me why the Portuguese capital is so perfect for such an event.
Yes, we did want to have different layers of use, and not having buildings by this contemporary architect and not others, you know. So we try to make that balance, because the audience has to be attracted by all these places, and some people are attracted by only palaces and others only contemporary architecture. And Lisbon is really nice because it has all those layers. It has all those layers since, I don't know, 12th century till nowadays. And some buildings really have that in them.
You'd think it would be difficult getting 60 venues to open their doors for free to the general public, especially as Open House Lisbon has demands beyond just that and relies on volunteers. At the Royal Astronomy Observatory, we are taken up to the tower where an 18th century telescope sits in sunlit streams of dust. At MOOD, the Museum of Fashion and Design downtown, the vaults of the concrete brutalist building, formerly a bank, are open to the public for the first time. Patricia Marquez, Open House Lisbon coordinator, believes that the city has embraced the spirit of architectural access.
I think it's always a victory because you're always dealing with someone that has no reason to open their house, and they do it freely. And even a museum or a place that usually does that, what we are asking is on that weekend you should propose something slightly different to visitors. And instead of showing them what you are exhibiting, you're showing the building. So it's always, that's really nice. And I think when the public really responds to that, as it did this year again, because we had a lot of public, it's really good to know that, okay, there's really people who are interested about this. And sometimes, for instance, at Carpe Diem this year, we weren't expecting a big crowd because the building is always open, so public can go there. But we had these guided tours about the building, and we talked about it, and by the end of one afternoon, there were 800 people there. So it's really massive, and we had no idea of knowing this was going to happen. So every time we have new surprises.
One striking addition to the open house roster that you can get to by tram is Casa de Moeda, Portugal's former national mint and a modernist icon in terms of the country's public work schemes in the 1930s. The site, whose main entrance is marked by a play of volumes and coatings that differ to the rest of the rationalist interiors, is one of the favourites of architect and open house curatorial consultant Fernando Sanchez Salvador.
Casa de Moeda is a very singular building, projected by an ancient and very modern Portuguese architect, Jorge Segurado, and was the building where the money was kept. And so, with the big structure in the interior and very, very well done, very good materials, very well projected, the materials and the spaces are very, very qualified. And people don't know that space. The large people don't know. So I think it's a very interesting building to visit and to see. Lisboa, it's an amazing city. It's a very interesting city with space. When I speak about space, are qualified space not only projected by architects, but sometimes with people we don't know whom they are, or ancient places and spaces. So Lisboa has a quality very interesting, and most of the places we don't know because are not obvious, you understand? And so it's with that idea that opens the open house.
Though Lisbon's second open house is now over, it is clear that the city has plenty of urban wonders to explore before next year's offering. For Monocle in Lisbon, I'm Saima Tariq.
And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Today's show was produced by Aled John and edited by Holly Fisher. You can contact Aled awj@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on Section D. I'm Tom Morris. I'm playing you out today for a show that's been bookended by our stories from Canada and Portugal. Who better to play us out than our favourite Porto-Canadian songstress, Nelly Furtado? Here's All Good Things Come to an End. See you next week. Bye-bye.